At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. You've got the stitch bug. This is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Daniel Clough, aka Fiance Knowles, is a South African artist known for her vibrant and expressive embroidery work. Danielle's art is characterised by bold colours, movement and layering, creating a visual impact that instinctively evokes joy. Danielle believes in the inherent goodness of people and the power of support and validation in fostering self-confidence. And you can tell her love of humanity is embedded in every single piece that she makes. This is the first part of our needle exchange, and I love talking with Danielle. I could have talked with Danielle for weeks. In the first part of this chat, we discover what it's like living in Cape Town. We go on Danielle's embroidery journey. Did you know she invented embroidery? We talk about her fashion design influences, and then the reality of being a professional creative. We have an in-depth conversation about commercial work, what it is like to get commercial work, tips and tricks, and how you balance that with your own personal artistic journey. It's great. You're going to love Danielle. If you haven't seen her on Instagram, where have you been? Go and find Fiance Knowles. You'll see her work. It's absolutely magnificent. And we dig a lot more into that in the second part of our Needle Exchange, which will be out next week. But I'm so pleased to talk to her. Could talk to her for days. Bound to get her back on the show at some point if I can. I hope you enjoy this needle exchange. I'm sure you will. Do let me know if you enjoy the show, and if it's groovy for you, then please share it with somebody else who you know will like her work and appreciate her outlook on life. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation, so in the meantime, enjoy the show. This is a dumb question. What season is it?
It is autumn, so it's the opposite of yours. I reckon you're going in spring, right?
We're sort of spring starting to mosey towards summer.
Yeah, so we're moseying towards winter now. I can actually see a rainbow over the sea because it's been raining, so I literally can see it. And then, wait, can you see it? Can you see it?
You are very much just on the sea there, aren't you?
Can you see the rainbow?
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's a treat for the audio listeners here. Yeah, treat.
You'll see I've got very clean teeth and a rainbow. Yeah. So the weather's turning. It's just getting cold. It's getting a little bit like, you know, like slippers, heaters, inside weather, which is like my favorite because it's productive. So yeah, it's good.
And what's Cape Town like?
Cape Town in general or at the weather?
Yeah,
the weather?
Imagine I've never been there. Hard as that is.
It is. It's amazing. It's like I'm born and bred Capetonian, so I don't really know much else. But like the older I'm getting, the more I'm kind of interested in being engaged in my city, and I think like and in nature. Cape Town's incredible. Like, it's literally, I'm currently wedged between like the sea and the mountain. And we've been going on hikes literally just behind my house. I've started surfing. So it's really beautiful, really amazing. It's super, I mean, South Africa is incredibly diverse. So you just have this like just stimulation of like culture and music. And it's just, yeah, I love it. It's home and I love it. And I'm really enjoying utilizing the city for what it has to offer.
Yeah. And the summer's like really, really hot.
Yeah. Yeah, really hot, really hot. And windy in Cape Town, super windy. If you go further north, like if you're in Joburg, the summers are completely different. It's like humid and you get those like tropical rains. But Cape Town, very windy, very hot, very beautiful. So, yeah.
It's a little known fact that English people, when they go above a certain temperature, melt like candles. And it's true. They come back a lot shorter and a lot more sort of messy. So,
yeah. You can always spot an English tourist here as well. They're always very sunburned. Very.
I forget. Like, I've had no hair on my head since about the year 2000. I still forget. And also, and this is a dumb confession, is I forget that my head extends higher than my eyes. So we used to have a shed, and I would walk into the door frame of the shed about six times a year because I sort of forget about the space above my eyes in terms of my head.
How are you? How's your driving?
It's getting steadily worse the more I bang my head. It's not bad. I'm getting to that old man vibe where I'm determined that I'm right. I've got the right of way, even if I'm on the wrong side of the street or something. It's just a thing that... Hey, but do we drive on the same side of the road?
Yes, we do. We do.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, we do. But I'm also getting that indignation that like even if you forget to indicate and somebody hoots, you're like, come on, where's your patience? And then if somebody forgets to indicate, you're like, come on, don't you know how to use it? You know that thing, you know, that whole like completely self-absorbed, the world revolves around your driving style. And then my aunt said to me the other day, which I absolutely love, she says, if you're sitting in traffic, it's because you are traffic. And that's like, you know, I love that. Yeah,
that's very meta, isn't it? Yeah, very meta. Yeah. If someone stands on your foot, do you apologize to them? Or if someone bumps into you?
Yeah.
Not you bump into someone. Someone bumps into you.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder whether there's a turning point on that as well. I feel like I'm stopping to do that now because I've realized it's just a waste. Or like if you...
Do you feel like your sorries are finite and you're like, oh, I wasted another sorry?
10,000 sorries, and I need to save approximately 8,000 of those just for my wife.
Or you can also just say yes, dear. That usually works.
Yes, dear. Yeah, I've learned that there are times when I just have to be agreeing and not try and solve problems. I don't want to get into a whole like male feminist men are from Mars debate right now or whatever, but I know that there are times. Also, I've learned, and I've said this to other people, like in the pecking order of my house, I'm firmly at the bottom because I have three strong and powerful women, even though one of them is seven and the other one's five. I just know that I'm at the bottom of the list. But I was sort of trying to say to someone that resignation is very freeing because you're not fighting it anymore. You just go, yeah, whatever.
Do you always get the smallest towel?
I usually find my towel has been used by someone else. Yeah. Do you know what happened the other day? Sorry for anybody who's in wanting to listen about art. But the other day, Annie, my five-year-old, got into my bed and I went into her bed. But because she decided to change the bedding, I was actually having to sleep under like a cot bed, like duvet, which meant I had to put like socks on. There was no way for me to be fully covered by the duvet. And I just lay there like, yeah, what?
Well, these are the beautiful sacrifices of being the dad, right? It's like, that's family.
Here's another sad thing then. This is quite sad now, right? Have you heard Annie's song by John Denver? You fill up my senses like a night forest. It's a little bit...
Yes.
So there's that song. There's a couple of cheesy songs that have now got meaning. But with that song, because our daughter's called Annie, we sing it to her quite a lot. And I remember once I was having to drive around to get her to sleep and listening to it. And there's a bit where it says, I will drown in your laughter. I will die in your arms. And I think that's a really like beautiful sentiment for a parent. And by like the eighth time of listening to it on the loop, I'm like driving around just like literally crying in my car. I'm just going, that's so nice.
It's so true.
And the other one that's a bit cheesy now, because I think of songs, sometimes I like to sing to the girls when I'm asleep. And for some reason, popular choices have been Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding, which is fine, except it's about a man who's clearly quite depressed because he's just sitting on the dock of the bay wasting time.
He's not actually having a great time. Yeah.
No. And then another song that sprang to mind has been I Will Survive by Donna Summer, which both of the girls can now sing. So sometimes you walk down the street singing that, which is pretty good. But the other one that I quite like now is Just Like Me by The Carpenters. Again, super cheesy. But it's like when you sing it to your kids, you're like, why do birds suddenly... Anyway.
That's a classic. That's a classic. That feels very... I always thought if I ever did Idols, that's the song that I would choose. But I would never do Idols. I am musically inept.
Are you? And yet...
Yeah, completely.
And yet, you used to be a VJ. What's that all about?
Well, a VJ is kind of like... It was me trying to like live out my musical dream without actually having to do anything musical. So the VJ is obviously just the video jockey. So I kind of thought of it as dancing with pictures. You know, you play you play the appropriate visuals to the appropriate song. You get the beat right. I think the beat is not hard to get because you've got to press like this button on the beat. And, you know, that's pretty much like as much of a musical talent as I have. but I'd always dreamed of being like the lead singer in a band. I had this like amazing... I can't remember. I think it's Love Fox from CSS used to wear this like full latex sequin covered one piece. And she just like throw herself around the stage and kick things. And I was like, that resonates with me.
I mean, you're wearing it now for the people that aren't able to see it. It's amazing that you've got that outfit and that it's you wear it well, especially with the slippers.
Thank you.
And was that, being a VJ, that was where the name Fiance Knowles came from, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it was just like kind of an inside joke. I was, at the time I was dating a DJ and I'd always wanted to be a VJ and somebody joked and called me Fiance Knowles. And I thought, if I ever do anything that ends up on a poster, remember when there were posters? I would be Fiance Knowles. And then I joined a hip hop collective called Uppercut. And then, yeah. And then I just kind of, they were like, what do you want your name to be? And I said, Fiance Knowles. And then I made that my Instagram account name and it just stuck. And I think when in 2016, when my work kind of picked up momentum and I've got quite a few more followers, I thought I could change my name back now and like, you know, take myself seriously, or I could just leave it and not take myself seriously. So I just left this and here we are.
Yeah, pseudonyms are a useful thing, aren't they? I always think, like, Mr. X-Stitch. I once got ChatGPT to write in the style of Mr. X-Stitch, which was quite funny, because I wrote something and then it wrote it better. Because Mr. X-Stitch, according to ChatGPT, is a lot more sort of alliterative and a bit more like, hey, everybody, I'm going to talk like this because I'm the kingpin of contemporary embroidery. That sort of thing.
Amazing. Isn't it nice that that's what the internet thinks of you?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a lot worse, let's face it. That's true, really. I don't think there's anybody on the planet that isn't aware of your work, but if nobody has ever seen your work before, how would you describe it?
It's kind of like painting with thread. So I use stitches to, in like highly saturated colors to interpret usually portraits or nature. So flowers, animals, faces, and I guess it would be called, I would say it's quite bold, colorful, and maybe a little bit like along the lines of impressionism, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I always find it so difficult to explain your own work because you're just really sitting thinking about like how you're going to do the next thing, let alone what you did in the past.
Is there a worry that the minute you go, well, this is what my work's like, then your creative energy goes, well, I don't think it's going to be like that anymore. We're going to move on.
Yeah, I think that, and I think also like deciding what you are means that you become kind of like calcified in that. So there's something quite nice about being like, well, I don't really know yet. So then you're just like always, you feel a lot more malleable and like things can just keep moving and changing. And I guess when I look back at like the work that I've created, there's consistency, but I like the idea of not having too much about like what I am and what I do, so that even though it's the same, there's still room to change.
Well, I think then it's fair for me to say what you are, isn't it? It's probably easier for an external viewpoint or whatever. And I always think about your work. If you can tell your work at a distance, like you say, because of the saturation of color, And I think there's something about like the use of strokes as well, like the way you deliver your stitches are almost, I guess it is, it's a bit like, is it Van Gogh's kind of paintings, you know, those small, colourful, quite not necessarily a lot of blending, but at the same time, a lot of coherence within the colour, but definitely vibrant. Yes.
Vibrance, and I think movement. I think maybe the brush strokes, the stitch strokes create movement, which is not something I do on purpose. It's not something that I like intentionally set out to do. It's just kind of the way that I work. So I think maybe that's why it was so hard to explain it, because it's not like I'm going to do this and that's what I am. I'm kind of like sitting there just trying to figure it out.
But then the first time I remember seeing your work and my jaw hitting the floor, first but not last, tennis rackets.
Yes.
Tennis rackets. Let's talk about the tennis racket.
Yeah, the tennis racket started, I think, in 2015. I did my first one. So it was, you know, the stroke of genius. No, it wasn't a stroke of genius. Somebody showed
me a heart. It's a trademark
phrase. Somebody showed me like a heart woven onto a racket, kind of just almost like just the stitches wrapped around to create like a pixel heart. And I was like, this is a challenge, isn't it? And I went that day and I went to this market called Millerton Market, and I bought like a 2 or 3 secondhand rackets, and I kind of just started trying to figure out how to stitch something a little bit more expressive and a little bit more fluid, and like using my style onto a racket. So then I stitched onto a racket and I did like 2 or 3. And I think that was kind of the beginning of my, it actually was the beginning of my career. So I would stitch 1 or 2 and I put it online, and you know, just kind of like on Facebook when you were like, look what I did today. Look at my coffee. Look at my breakfast. Look at this weird little racket thing I made. And a friend was like, can I buy that? And I was like, I guess, you know, okay. And then I made another one, and then I made another, and I put them on a website because I was actually applying for this kind of program that they have in Cape Town called Design in Durban. At the time I was working as a graphic designer, and I was waitressing and I was VJing, and I was kind of doing anything for money, anything to survive, pay rent. And then as a hobby I was sewing, and then I made this racket and I put it online and I made a few, and I thought, oh, I'm gonna apply for Design in Durban. As I kind of thought of myself as like a conduit of embroidery, I didn't think my work was ever gonna make my career as an embroiderer happen, but I was like, oh, I'm gonna collect vintage embroideries and turn them into jewelry or bags. Or I just loved embroidery, and I just wanted to find like a way of like repurposing it and putting it out in the world. So I had applied for Design in Durban kind of under that vision. And then, yeah, I made these rackets. So I put them on my website that I was building to my Design in Durban application. And then the rackets just went viral. They just like overnight. I woke up with like 10,000 new followers. The next morning it was 20. The next morning it was 30. And I had all of these kind of like people contacting me, like from the Mental Floss to Vogue to just, it was mad. So the rackets really just kickstarted my career.
Yeah. The thing is with the rackets though, is that it's not just like, you know, there's a grid formation on the racket, which naturally lends itself to like pixelation. And you can see that as quite an easy, but yours is like some kind of witchcraft, because you create these forms that are so organic and round and don't seem to make sense against a grid structure that they're created on. Like how without giving the trade secrets away, how does it work? Like how do you do that?
You just make fabric. You just essentially make the fabric with wool. Yeah, that's the secret.
Yeah, so,
there it goes. There's just that's it, basically.
Simple. Just do that. No, but I mean, is it like an iterative thing? Like you just build the layers. Like I was talking to Meredith Woolnow, and she does those organic pieces, machine embroidery, soluble fabric. And it's very much, yeah, you're creating the fabric with your stitches. So your starting formation isn't going to be the end product. It's more like structural architecture, engineering. And so I'm guessing that's the same approach you take.
Totally. Exactly. So you're just layering. All my work is really based on layering. So it just works at layering. And then so that it builds up to being something concise and hopefully beautiful.
And then just, and yeah, and they are beautiful. I think that's the thing. You just look at them, and I can see why they're so successful. I can see why all of your work is so popular, because it just looks like beautiful oil painting. You know, there's something that just, you know, like some work's designed to like provoke in different directions, but with yours, it always, to me, just makes my heart sing a little bit.
Oh, that's really like, that's amazing, because that's really what I want for my work to do. I think I come from kind of a commercial corporate background. I studied advertising, so I understand like art needs to say things and needs to express and all of that. And for me, it's this kind of like a way that I want to explore the world and explore materials. And then to just like evoke joy is just such an amazing kind of, to hear that to me is just so beautiful. That's that's what I want. I just want my work to make people feel good.
And it must do, right? Because the proof's in the pudding, I suppose. You're an extremely popular needleworker. You've had lots of, I mean, one thing I did want to talk about is your, like, the commercial success, I guess, you've had and the way you've been able to do that. But there's a like, pre-conversation before all of that. But, I mean, it must be, I don't know what I'm trying to say, really. I was going to say, do you believe in yourself? That sounds a bit daft. But it's like, I guess there's, for a lot of people, when they're putting their work out there, you need that kind of validation. I guess you got your validation pretty hard and pretty fast at the start.
Well, I thought about this a lot, you know, because I teach and because I mentor and I speak to people in different levels and different places in their career. And by no means do I think that I'm like at the top, and I have mentors and I go to mentors even now. I just also believe in that kind of like that sharing and that openness of like where you're at and what you can give and how everyone can share. But I've noticed that there's a lot of self-doubt in most of us. And trying to figure out, you know, an imposter syndrome and all these kind of like buzzwords for, not that imposter syndrome is just a buzzword, but there's a lot of language around those feelings of self-doubt, insecurities, maybe a lack of confidence, anxiety around your work, imposter syndrome, all of that. And trying to figure out like, what are the differences but that some people have and that other people don't? And so, because, you know, sometimes people are like so confident and they put their work out, so how? what are you hinging this like absolute confidence on? Especially when it comes to music. You're like, gosh, that's terrible. But I realize it's support, you know. I feel really grateful. My parents aren't necessarily creative. I would say my mom is not creative at all. And she's just so relentlessly supportive. You know, she'd be like, I'd come home with this like crazy haircut, be like bleach, and like a, I don't know if you know a purdy, it's like a solid bowl cut shaved underneath with like two long pieces, just like absolutely crazy, like alien. And she'd go, okay, I mean, I don't get it, but it's very you know.
Nice. Yeah.
And like, you know, stuff like that. So just kind of feeling like even your bad things are like, you're not, maybe they're maybe not perfect and they're not great, and you're not going to get like unwavering kind of like glorification, but that, you know, like, it's good, you're good, like, whatever you need, we're here, like, let us know. And that support really helps, I think, help me bolster a lot of like self-confidence and also set a tone that like, even if people don't like something, they're probably going to be nice, you know. And that like way of entering and living in the world, I think, has really helped me. So when I would make something, I would put it online and share it, not in the way that I was like, this is the greatest thing ever created, but kind of like, hey, look what I did, you know, or like, hey, this is cool. Or like, and I think that expectations that the world is nicer than maybe some other people have, you know, some, I think, has really helped me. And I think like, yeah, that's been, so with, I believe in myself is one thing, but I think it's more that like, I believe in others. I believe that people are like inherently nice and good and like seeing things that are different, and then they'll carry on with their lives and so will you.
Yeah, I wonder whether it, like, imposter syndrome is something you should all go through because it means you're transforming. You know, yeah. I wonder whether caterpillars go through a moment of imposter syndrome on the way to becoming butterflies. You know what I mean? Like, hang on a minute. Is this the butterfly I'm really meant to be? Maybe I'm more of a moth or something. But it's that pushing yourself out of your comfort zones, isn't it? It's that growth.
Totally. And I think imposter syndrome is very healthy in a way. It's also a part of like a creative process where you want more, we push ourselves, we want to be more creative, we want new ideas. And so you're constantly making yourself somewhat uncomfortable and in that discomfort. You're like, do I belong here? Is this right? Isn't this right? Is this, hang on, these people like this thing. I don't even know if it's, is it likable? Why do they like it? Like all of those kind of like questions are, I think like really like can really be a sign of like a strong will for betterment.
Yeah. It's the same with public speaking, isn't it? Some people, like these days, I don't really mind public speaking because I've done it so many times. But I can still remember being absolutely petrified in the first stages. And still, if it's something quite important, I still need to go to the loo just beforehand, almost immediately beforehand, is like part of the process, you know, because it still matters. But it's like that's the micro version of crushing dread, which is the thing you face the first time you step up to it.
Totally. And you know, like nerves, I always think about nerves. Whenever you're nervous, it means that you care, you know, and like you should be doing stuff in your life that you care about. So if you're nervous, you're like, ah, this is a byproduct of me doing something that matters.
Yeah, definitely. And if you don't feel that anymore, then get the bus home, because yeah, I think that's it. I'm often bewildered when I see people who are just like staring into space doing something. Like even if you're like working in a supermarket checkout, which I've done, or pushing shopping trolley. I used to have a job pushing shopping trolleys, which is about as the most unfulfilling job you had, but we decided to see what the longest number of shopping trolleys we could push. Answer 62. Sub answer, may 62. Hit car in cup. 62 shopping trolleys in one line. Quite hard to stop when it gets going, though, I'll tell you that much. Sorry to say, how many, the Land Rover,
how many corners?
Just a straight line at that point. Yeah, the curvature, okay. The physics. But I mean, seriously, you should see me wield a single shopping trolley now. It's like ballet, swear to God. How did you start all of this? Did you do much needle work when you were young?
My mom would make clothes. So she would make clothes for kids and stuff like that. And just she had like sewing around the house. So I think like I've never really thought about sewing, clothing, embroidery, anything that's like a creative outlet, and always just kind of felt like just like, nah, this is making, you know, it's around the house, whatever. And then I got really into the idea of being a fashion designer. So I was like, I'm gonna be Fishhook. Fishhook is a very strange little town in Cape Town that I grew up in. I was like, I'm gonna be Fishhook's next Coco Chanel. And I dropped out of mainstream school, and I studied a visual arts matric. So I did like a kind of an alternative matric, and I was like, this is all so that I can be this incredible fashion designer. And at the time, my mom was kind of like would show me how to use a sewing machine. So I'd make clothes out of like old curtains, and they would like, so I couldn't put my arms down, but I was like super chuffed. And then I studied fashion for 2 weeks, and I was like, I kind of hate this. And I had like really known when I said the visual arts matric, I really knew what it was to like love what I did. Like I just loved it. We did potato print. I mean, who wouldn't love doing potato printing as a school subject? But we did potato printing. We did like graphic design. We did all of these things. And I just like, it just resonated. Like it just felt so good in my body. And then I did fashion and I was like, oh, not for me. So I saw my mom. I was like, Mom, I really don't want to do this. The pragmatic, amazing woman that she is. She said, if you're going to drop out, do it now so we can get our money back. I was like, okay, cool. Better commit. And then I'd spent the next kind of year just interning, just doing a bunch of stuff through a process of elimination, figuring out what I like didn't want to do. And then I decided to study advertising because it really encompassed the biggest kind of range of creative outlets. Because I kind of figured like, I actually think I just want to do everything. And advertising with art direction, it had like, you could go from conceptualizing to executing your projects using photography or using craft and all of that. So while I was studying advertising, it happened to be above a fabric store. And my like fellow colleague students would draw these little like monsters, and I'd run down to the fabric store and I would buy fabric, and then I would start like stitching these monsters or characters together from my, you know, just from my like very basic sewing background with my mom. And yeah, then these kind of monsters started evolving, and the little like doodles, like I would do like a little anchor, and then the doodles started like growing and getting a little bit more complex, and then I stitched a face onto a piece of fabric, and then that just, yeah, that kind of just became a little bit more complicated, and then became.
And that was all kind of self-taught. It was all just like feeling it out.
Yeah, Yeah, definitely. The embroidery aspect definitely was just self-taught. I'll confess this before, but I'll confess again. I thought that I had invented embroidery. I had like a piece of scrap felt from in my bag from making these toys and just a needle and thread. And I was working at a gallery and the gallery owner was like, you need to email people for sales. And I was like, cool. And I had a laptop that he gave me and I could not open it. Like I could not for the life of me open it. I was trying to like press the little buttons and this would not open. And later on, I realized that those buttons were actually hinges. Cool. Very chill. And then I had to look busy because if he came down and I was just sitting there empty-handed, then he would know that I was the type of person who couldn't open a laptop. So I looked through my bag and all I had was a scrap piece of fabric and felt. And then I just used it and I kind of drew a picture of a bunny. And I was like, oh, yeah. I've invented something new. Nobody knows about this thing where you can use thread to make pictures. I'm calling it thread sketching. I put it on my blog. I used to have a blog called Mother Cluffer. And I put it on my blog and I was like, I've invented this thing called thread sketching. And that's how my journey of embroidery started. It was pure arrogance.
I think you might have invented thread sketching though. The fact that it's universally considered as embroidery is just semantics, surely.
I know. And you know, has anyone ever stitched an only red thread?
Yeah, no. Yes, well, yes. I mean, other than the red work artists, yeah, no, surely not.
Other than like the whole of Eastern Europe for the last like 300 years, 400 years.
Yeah. Can you remember what it was about fashion that didn't float your boat?
It felt too restrictive. So I kind of wanted to like conceptualize stuff. I wanted to do the prints on the fabric. And I think it just was like, that is something that you would get to, but I just wanted to do it all now, today, you know? So, and coming from doing that, like alternative visual arts where we did something like kind of creative every day, it just felt too linear and a little bit too slow, I guess. We did history of fashion, which weirdly I love. But the actual process, the creative element of it just wasn't thrilling enough for me at that time.
Yeah. So you're more sort of big picture. Would it be like you'd see the fashion shows and maybe upon reflection, like running the fashion show is the thing, not necessarily making the clothes that go in the fashion show? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, I think it would be the making of the clothes, you know, but I think it would be like, I just wanted to do it all that day. I wanted to draw the picture. I wanted to like paint on the fabric. I wanted to cut the fabric out. And obviously you're starting a course from scratch. They were like, this is a pattern. And I was like, I don't want to draw, you know, this is a French curve. And I'm like, all of this. And I mean, I have huge respect for fashion designers because of how nuanced all those details are. But I'm not that detail orientated. I mean, if you see the back of my embroideries, it's kind of like it arcs my personality. I would love to do something with fashion now, like a whole capsule. But I think, you know, I want to like draw and paint and do and put it all together as opposed to like what actually to be a real good fashion designer requires, which is patience.
There's a show that me and my wife Mary have been watching lately over here called Interior Design Masters. So it's a bit like the Great British Bake Off, but instead of making cakes, they're like designing spaces, commercial spaces. So obviously it starts off with like, you know, 8 people, goes down to 2 for the final. But within that, they have to like design the rooms. They have tradespeople to help, but there's a lot of those bits and pieces, you know, creating ideas to go into it, sometimes building things, definitely painting the ceilings, all of those sorts of stuff. And it is just like that total package, you know what I mean? I reckon you'd be awesome.
Totally. Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting to see kind of like also how these things connect. So there was obviously something in me that loved fabric, loved fashion. And like subsequently I've worked in fashion. I worked for Gucci, I worked for Joby, I've done some shoe designs for Adidas, stuff like that. And it's amazing to be able to be a part of that. So it's really cool to see that like nothing goes to waste, you know, and like that you obviously have like a core narrative and a core kind of dream, if that makes sense. And that if you just keep following your intuition, that these pieces will like pull together and create like the bigger picture.
Yeah. And upon reflection, you can kind of see that. But at the time, it's like, who's to say, isn't it? Like you say, just follow your intuition. So you invented needlework. Let's call it. You invented embroidery. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you did some stuff with tennis rackets. What happened in betwixt those times?
Well, the inventing of the embroidery happened while I was studying art direction and when I was studying at Red and Yellow. And then I left Red and Yellow, finished, graduated, and I started working at a media company called Media 24. And we were working designing apps when there was the iPhone 1 came out. So we're kind of ahead of our time. Yeah, that was very cool. But I was the junior. So I was doing a lot of weird things like banners for websites where you can win a gun, strange things. And then I also did that for a while, and I just kind of got really uncomfortable. I was this is just not it. This is not the thing. Working the 9-to-5 wasn't, I was also waitressing while I was studying, and I kind of missed, weirdly enough, I missed waitressing. I missed being on my feet. I missed the social element of it. So I left. I'm excellent at quitting. I'm a great quitter. I'm a huge advocate for quitting. Not stopping working, but quitting.
I was curious about art direction, because it sounds like it could be something that's brilliant, but it sounds like it could be, I don't know, massive. How would you, what's art direction? How do you do art directing?
I guess art direction is kind of concept orientation. It depends on what industry. So if you are in a film, art directing something would be deciding on its look and its feel, kind of making sure that your wardrobe, your everything kind of fits within that. From my understanding of art direction in film, when it comes to advertising, it's your concept. It's your, you would work with a copywriter to build to build the concept, the look and feel of an advert. So in a way, it's actually been really beneficial to have this strong corporate background, because I've been able to look at my work, brand it, see myself kind of as a corporate entity in a way, and then package myself, my work, my workshops, my kits, things like that. I don't know if I've done a great job of it, but I'm definitely trying. And I think it helps, as opposed to coming at it purely from an artist perspective, which is wonderful, but just for my personality doesn't really work. But to just be about the work and then to see where it goes, the art direction, graphic design kind of background and education has given me tools to package myself and to do things with autonomy, really to be able to kind of see the big picture and do all the little bits that it requires to fulfill it.
Because one of the things that's always been impressive to me is some of the collab work that you've done. Because you said, you've worked with some big names. You've done trainers with Adidas, which to me feels about as big as it can get. Can you talk about that? How you go about it, what the process is, how much fun it is?
Oh, it's super fun. I think the first thing that if I had to give advice to anybody who, especially from a needlework perspective, who gets approached by brands, make sure that the brand aligns with your ethos and that the project aligns with what you want to be doing with yourself and your career. Needlework is just, it takes so long. So to be doing something with resistance is really, really bad, and it will come out in the work, and it will really be such a waste of your own time as well as your client's time. So it's just don't do it. I'm hyper protective over what I take on. So I make sure that if I do take on a job, it's something that I'm either find challenging or I know that there's going to be a benefit at the end of the day that will keep me passionate and excited about the project. So that's my main thing. I think if I had to say to anybody, if corporate approaches you, make sure that you're 100% invested in the job, be protective of your time and your aesthetic and your all of that. And then I love working. I think having a background with corporate, working as a designer, it's really helped me in a way that I'm able to compartmentalize things. This is a job. The client is sometimes right, not always, but they're sometimes right. You are doing something for them within their vision, and to collaborate is important, but that also means that you need to listen. Criticism is also okay. You can't be super sensitive every time. They're like, is it like, and most corporates are really good, and they'll be like, we absolutely love it. But if you don't like, could we just try a version that's like this and this? Don't like get into a strop, because then it's fun, you know, then you get to work with people. And usually, you know, you see a job like you or a brand and it's somebody like Adidas and you're like, oh, wow. You know, you're dealing with these like big powers that be, but actually they're employees that work for this company that are like usually super excited for the projects as well. And like, you just like work to make sure that you get to draw that magic out of each other and make it as fun as possible. And yeah, I've been very protective over what I take on, and I've loved the works that I've been able to do with a lot of these big brands. Even I've done a few projects that are kind of even more corporate, like medical work. And yeah, it's been amazing. It's been really amazing.
Do you have a sort of like three drafts and then I'm going to go for it kind of perspective? Because I guess you can iterate as much as you like, and that's fine when it's digital. But when it's something analog, mm-hmm. like needlework, presumably there has to come a point where you go, right, I've got to do this now.
Yeah, so I have quite a strict setup when it comes to that, kind of like a T's and C's, where I'm like, okay, we're going to do some digital drawings. Either I supply the reference image or you supply the reference image. We have to sign off on that reference image before we go to the next step. So you have to be sure that this is, say now it's a portrait of a person. You go, this, make sure that this is the one that you want, because further down the line, you can't change it. Then I'll do digital drawings. So then the digital drawings will be with Procreate on the iPad. I'll do like one or two ideas with it, colorways, things like that. And then I now have a set, like three free change rule. And then over mm-hmm. and above that, there's an hourly fee, just because for time constraints. And then what I also do is I'll have like, if they have a deadline, say now the deadline is at the end of April, I know the piece is going to be however big, then I'll say, okay, the drawing needs to be signed off by this date in April, because I need 3 weeks to sew. So just kind of like having some terms that are quite strict before, and I'll just be like, okay, here's for the nitty gritty. Like, these are the things for me to be able to make work that you're going to be happy with and I'm going to be happy with. Because, you know, you need to be considerate of your time. And clients, they don't know how long something takes. Oh, like, they just don't. It's up to you to kind of essentially educate them on that process. You know, even things like colors. So they'll be like, we need this color. And I'll be like, I can get as close to that color as possible, but I'm restricted by the threads that I have access to. So here's the if it's DMC, here's the DMC book of colors. Mm. Take a pick, go mad. I'll buy as many 880s as you need, you know? So things like that.
And then the flip of that is, we don't know how much budget they've got. Like, I always think pricing is the hardest thing for someone, particularly who's new to this. Like, have you got any tips? Would you say think of a number, stick an extra zero on the end of it and make that your first pitch or any of that sort of stuff?
Like I said, clients kind of know what they want, but also don't know. And they don't know like the rules and the variables that it requires. So say now they're like, oh, I want a picture of my dog. So you're like, okay, great. Now, how much is it going to be? Well, it depends on the picture of the dog, right? So if you're doing a picture of the whole dog or just the face, if it's the whole dog and they want the face and the details and the eyes, then the whole thing needs to be bigger. So you kind of have to say, okay, once I know the scope of the project, I'm able to quote appropriately. So then we'll do that. Other jobs, I'll say there's two ways to go about it. One, like, let's work on what the scope of the project is, and then I'll cast accordingly. Or you can let me know what your budget is, and then we can work the scope of the project based on the budget. So if your budget is £2, it can be this big. If it's £20, it can be that big. So this, I kind of do that, because a lot of the time, especially in the, especially with big, big brands, they know what they have. They're like, we've got £40,000 for this. We have £2 for this. They'll know. They actually know, and they'll tell you, like, that's a bit out of budget. So it's like, you knew that all the time. You got those numbers. Tell me what those numbers are. You know, so.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing, isn't it? And that's where the imposter syndrome again kind of kicks in, isn't it? Because you've got to kind of hold your nerve. I am no expert at this, but I know that, you know, you have to be firm and you have to defend your territory and be willing to just ask them quite openly what the budget is. And if they are a bit cagey, maybe go back and challenge that. Would that be right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, I give them the option to be like, look, there's two ways to do this. You can let me know what the budget is, and I'll scale the work based on your budget. And like, transparently, or what your budget is based on. I recently got contacted about a job, and they told me what the they in the email said our budget is this, which is quite a fair amount below what I would charge for an original. So I said, but they just need it for a digital thing. So I said, that's okay, we'll totally do this. But you know, under the terms that I keep the original work that I can then hopefully sell on. So there's ways to make it work. Again, if the project resonates with you, because if the money doesn't make sense and it's not good enough, don't do it, because it's going to feel awful. You know, you're going to get an email from them at like 12 at night, and you're going to be like, you don't pay me enough to answer an email at midnight, you know. So if the money is good, you don't have that, you feel good. Again, always just protect your joy around the work and your value. And I do the same as well. Like, I don't overcharge, because it doesn't, at least what I feel like, I don't overcharge, because that also feels ugly.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're sitting with like, how do I give them everything that I can under this, you know, within this context, because I feel like it's worth more than they're giving me.
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? You wish you could just take the gameplay out of it, but unfortunately the gameplay is part of it, isn't it? So that people can, like, don't know, get the best value from their standpoint.
Yeah. And you just have to, it just has to make sense to you. You know, you can guess that, you know, it's the same as like one person can find something cheap, another person finds it expensive. It's like all subjective at the end of the day. So you really have to keep your center with that and go like, this is what I think is going to make sense to me. I'm going to do the work really well with this number. I'm not going to feel guilty because I'm overcharging. I'm not going to feel taken advantage of because I'm undercharging. And if I lose the job because the numbers don't make sense, that's fine. I have space to create something else.
How do you manage the balance between commercial work, which can be financially valuable, and then your own artistic path?
That's a very interesting question. I have found, I've recently kind of, about a year ago, kind of hit a bit of a wobble, because I realized that I haven't taken on commercial work to avoid doing my personal work.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah.
It's so much,
like procrastination.
It's like procrastination. Yes. It's also having a sounding board. You know, it's like, so this person likes my work. They've given me a brief. I can fulfill it. I can make them happy. I know that it will be okay because they say it's okay. So I'm actually not responsible emotionally for any of this stuff, if that makes sense. So I took on a lot of corporate work always. And then kind of was like, oh, I'll make this piece that I've been wanting to make for 2 years when it's done. I'll make this when it's done. And I just kept taking on these jobs and these jobs and these jobs because, again, you've got the financial incentive, you've got the kind of validation that it gives you, and you've got the brief. So, you know, when you're just making work for yourself, it's boundless. So you don't have the guardrails maybe as a designer as well, I enjoy the brief, I enjoy the guardrails, I enjoy, so, okay, it can only be this big and use 2 colors. Perfect. Great. Now I know what to do and how to go. And then I can have ideas within that. So, yeah, so I think I spent a lot of time last year in New Zealand with my mom. She was going through treatment. And then, you know, I couldn't really do much commercial work while I was there because I had limited space. I just took a whole bunch of my materials. And then I had to start working towards a show. So finding that balance it's very difficult. You just kind of have to be self-aware of, like, again, that joy and that feeling inside of, like, what? Why am I not doing what I want to do? Am I enjoying this? What do I need? And then you go like, what does my career need as well? Which, I don't know the answer to that.
How long do you think you can pull the wool over your own eyes for that stuff? Because it's like creative procrastination, isn't it? It's like your office is never tidier than when you've got a deadline. It's all of those kind of things, isn't it? Doing something useful, but not the thing you're meant to be doing.
Oh, forever. I don't think it ever ends. I realized just the other day, I was like, I was thinking about original thoughts and how, like, often do we actually have original thoughts, or how often are we just like saying the same things? And then I was like, I don't know if I've had an original thought for a long time, especially when it comes to this. I've been like, why am I not doing my own work? Why am I not more disciplined? Why can't I get a routine down? Why? And I was like, I have been feeling this for about 10 years. and I don't think it's going to end. I think that this is going to see me all the way through. And that's maybe just the disposition, the creative disposition. I'm not productive enough. I'm not exercising enough. I'm not seeing my friends because I am being productive. I'm burnt out. Like, where that balance, that's constant, that balance playing that game.
I think one of the things I struggled with, like I've got a piece of cross stitch on the go now, which is like the first, not original idea, but the first creative idea I've had for myself in a very, very long time. And it's been interesting look back and see that idea coming. But then also I think sometimes, I see so much stuff on Instagram. You'll see people who've say your creative ideas are pointing in five different directions. You'll see people who are pointing in the same direction. And it's almost like that just knocks your trajectory. Like you suddenly think, oh, well, somebody's already done that thing. There's no point in me trying to do that. And you can kind of get buffeted along, can't you, down these different rails. And sometimes you think, I just need to go and sit up on a mountain for a month and then just I'll have an idea because I haven't been influenced by anything else.
Well, I have a theory about social media and Instagram and what it's robbing us of, because there's the comparative element of it, which is like what you're saying, is that you have this trajectory, you have this momentum, and then you scroll and you see something and then you're like, takes the wind out of your sail.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the other things that it takes from us, which is such a small but huge thing, is tinkering. I don't know when last you tinkered. I never tinker anymore. I used to tinker all the time. I was like, you sit and you're a little bit bored and then you take out like a piece of paper and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that thing. And you like look through a magazine, like, oh, such a nice picture. Maybe I should I want to draw this. But we just don't do that anymore. You sit like, I shouldn't speak for the rest of humanity. I spend my time scrolling 20, 30 minutes when I would have been bored, an hour in the day, however long, when I would have been bored, and harnessing that boredom and stimulating myself, understimulated looking at other people's things and then feeling like a little bit rubbish. You know, you're like, oh, I haven't updated my Instagram in a while. And should I be? And like, why haven't I? And then you're super critical, but you're still scrolling instead of just tinkering around.
Yeah. It reminds me of if you ever go to sell your house and how you, about a month before you sell your house or when the house goes on the market, you do all the jobs to make your house look nice that you haven't done in the 5 years you've been living in the house up to that point or something, you're just like, doing.
Yeah. It's so easy. It's so easy just to let it all slide. So I think those projects and those original ideas, now we have to, I think we have to be so much more conscious to carve out time for them because we just saturate ourselves.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.